and it made us calm. It wasn't like constricting at all to just
Right.
see half of the space and half of the wall. It just mattered of what she does in that space and how she lives. I really appreciated that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that adds to like the whole kind of simple living thing
And
that
Midori
she's
comes
not letting
into
all
the
that in.
shots
Exactly.
to join her,
They
to be
don't
taught
like
the.
accommodate the camera to expand to Midori or anything. Like
Right.
she joins her in doing this activity. And yeah, all of it, I don't know. It's just all really well thought out. Definitely would recommend
Yeah.
this movie. I'm wondering if we have time for one more song,
Song.
possibly. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah, we're gonna play a song and then we'll be out of here. So thanks for
Cool.
tuning in. We'll be back in a couple weeks with what movie, I'm not sure yet, but we'll catch you soon. Take
Bye.
care.
You're listening to CITR FM 101.9.
CITR Radio.
And these are the days of our lives.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
It is Friday, the 24th of April, 2020, and this is Dave Radio with Radio Dave on the radio. We are broadcasting live on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming on the World Wide Web at CITR.ca from an undisclosed location somewhere on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh people. On the program today, the Great Spring Stay-In continues. We're outside right now, sitting on the balcony of our lovely new home. The move was successful. Thanks for asking. On the program, we've got another episode from Chris King's From the Pit podcast. And this week it'll be his interview with local theater director and friend of the show, the great Sarah Rogers. It's the Radio for Shut-Ins version of Vancouver's go-to hour for local independent theater, film, and music, and it starts right now. Don't touch that dial. Well, hi there. So as I said, we are we're in our new home, just enjoying a sunny afternoon, looking at the view, watching traffic go by. There's we got all three. We've got SkyTrain, we've got the highway, and we got planes flying overhead every once in a while. So yeah, pretty nice, pretty nice. But it's been a crazy week. We've been packing and unpacking and cleaning and fighting and stressing and washing our hands. And so there hasn't really been much time to do much radio. But thanks to Chris King for letting us play another episode of his podcast series, From the Pit, we still have a show for you. From the Pit examines the world of musical theater from the point of view of the people who make it. It's very well put together. Great series of interviews. And you can find it at FromThePitPodcast.com. It's also available on iTunes. But make sure when you search for it, look for Chris King's From the Pit, because that's the one about musical theater. There's another podcast also called From the Pit, and it's about metal hardcore. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I just don't want to steer you in a direction you might not be expecting. So, we're going to hear about what it's like to be a director of musical theater from one of the most sought-after directors in the country, Sarah Rogers, from Chris King's From the Pit.
Putting on a musical is a big undertaking. Big budgets, big casts, and directing a musical is an equally big task. Where would you start? How do you make the show a success? Is directing a musical the same as directing a play? I'm Christopher King, and on today's episode, we talk with Sarah Rogers, one of Vancouver's busiest and most sought-after directors. We ask her about her process, her directing philosophy, and much more from The Pit. Sarah Rogers is a director, actor, and educator. She has directed musicals and plays at almost every theater company in Vancouver, including Gateway Theater, Theater Under the Stars, United Players, and Pacific Theater, just to name a few. Her next show is with the Arts Club Theater in their production of The Audience, which opens January 26th at the Stanley Theater. She holds an MFA in directing from the University of British Columbia, is a Jesse Richardson Theater Award winner, and has directed everything from classics to Ibsen to modern Canadian plays. No matter what she has done, her aesthetic and vision come through with great success. Today, I welcome my colleague and friend, Sarah Rogers. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. Lovely to be here.
Thanks for coming. I've had the pleasure of working with Sarah Rogers on both sides of the table. I've had the pleasure of acting in some of her shows, and as music director, we've been on the same production team numerous times. Together, we've done the last six shows at Theater Under the Stars, most recently West Side Story this past summer. Do you remember the first musical you directed?
The very first musical I directed would be my thesis project, and that was Oh, What a Lovely War by Joan Littlewood.
Right.
Now, many people would really probably say that that was a play with music, but a great deal of music,
right,
and a lot of singing and dancing.
Right.
So that was my thesis. And then my first professional directing project was for Simon Johnston out at Gateway Theater. Right. And I want to say it was Emily of New Moon, which was incredibly challenging piece.
Right.
And when Simon called me in and made this terrific offer, I said to him, I've never directed a big musical. And he said, well, I just came to see Oh, What a Lovely War, and I think that was a big musical.
Not intended, but it was a musical. That's amazing. So how did you find that experience working on the first musical? That must have been a different experience than you've had recently.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like my early days when I was so green. I think, and I have continued to do the same thing, which is always approach the work from the play first, from the script first, the story, and you know, what is the story about? This was a crazy piece to do as my first show because it was there are actually three novels to right. Emily of New Moon, and the playwright fell in love with all of them and so kind of amalgamated them into this 2-hour piece. So it was quite epic and right. quite challenging. But right. I had a great time using my imagination, great fun with the concept, and worked with Shelley Stewart Hunt, of course.
Yeah.
Great choreographer who we know well and have done lots with. And so she was quite a genius. One of the fun things we had is we had a big skating scene and I wanted to really look like skating, and I wanted to really explore the physicality of ice skating
right.
on the stage.
Right.
And we had a lovely costume designer that helped us design these shoes that actually looked like they had blades on them.
Amazing.
So, you know, Tricks,
tricks
and magic of theater.
Like I mentioned in the opening, that you're quite sought after. People ask you to do projects all the time.
Thank you,
Chris. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, how do you decide which projects you want to take? Is there any rules of thumb that you go by?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I have to love the story and the script. I love, writing is everything. Mm-hmm. I'm sure for you too, music is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so making sure that I can be invested in it. And frankly, you know, as time goes on, I just want to be interested. If there's something that I read that I just go, you know, I just don't think this will hold my attention.
Mm-hmm. I guess it could be quite a slog right? if you're not.
It's like, you know, this is just a bit too boring. I just don't think I can, I don't think I can live with this for, you know,
right.
6 months.
Of course.
So I have to love a piece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk about in theater as a director about finding the beauty.
Mm.
And I've really held on to that, which is find the beauty in the piece. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be a happy piece or a beautiful piece. It can be edgy. It can be threatening. It can be challenging. It can be dark. Mm. But there's beauty in it, like Angels in America.
Right,
you know, as a great script. So it's kind of for me about finding that hook in.
Mm.
And once I find that hook in, or I think, oh yeah, this is a piece that will ignite me and my imagination and I can get excited about, and then you know firsthand what that's like. Once I get into that fervored state and passion, then it's such a joy for everybody, for
right.
actors and the singers and my team. And then I think you always have a much better chance of creating an exciting piece of art.
Right.
When you have that passion and you really believe in the project.
One of the things that intrigued me that I wanted to ask you was when, and it may be a broader question, but how do you find the difference between doing a play as opposed to a musical? Like when you're researching a musical, does it differ from a play?
It does differ.
Right.
Yes, it does. It differs greatly in terms of music and lyrics. So songs.
Right.
When you have a play, you have the text. You have the text and then you have the period and the setting of it. I love to do a lot of background. Mm-hmm. I love to read a lot of books and I love to delve into the world, whether it's social, political, you know, whatever that period is. I love to immerse myself in it. So when you approach a play, you have the script and you have the dialogue, and that's going to inform you of the journey, and it's going to give you insight into the characters. And there's going to be a rhythm as well to good scripts and good writers. So they will write economically. For example, when I work with Pinter is almost like a jazz musician in that you will have very tightly back and forth text that will go back, and it will be in a very specific rhythm. Mm. And then all of a sudden you will get a jazz solo.
Mm.
Like all of a sudden you'll just get a monologue. And they're rare in Pinter.
Mm.
And so when they happen, it literally feels like, to me, it feels like you suddenly get this jazz solo. It's like all of a sudden, Pinter has given one of the players a solo.
Amazing.
So even when I approach a script, I can talk about it in musical terms because I still believe that there is a rhythm and there are words or notes. What's beautiful about working with musical is you get to go to a further level. Mm. You go to almost the, what I would call the fourth level in theater. In Shakespeare, when characters fall in love, when somebody gets murdered, when something huge occurs, an event occurs, that character will often suddenly speak in verse. So they will rhyme. They will start speaking in an iambic pentameter. They will have a rhyming couplet. And it takes them out of that everyday prose speech. It's because they're in a heightened state. Mm. Musicals give us this as well. When a character falls in love, for example, in a musical, suddenly they sing. Mm-hmm. So they move to this fourth level. So that informs me greatly as a director right there as I work my way through. So it isn't like, oh, here is this piece and we've got these 20 songs to work on.
Right.
And now let's just do this solo work. As the director, I have to, and it's a great joy, look at where those songs are placed and why. Why is the character at a point in this scene where all he or she can do is sing? The next level that I love about a musical, and this is really where I lean on my musical director greatly, mm-hmm. is not only am I looking technically at when are they singing and why, mm-hmm. what are they singing about, how is that furthering their journey. Now, all of that is still mostly in lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so I can do that. What I love, and this is something that Chris, you're so great at and, always inform me of, is musically what's happening. Musically, what is the composer telling us mm-hmm. about the journey, about the character? Are we getting repetition in the music? Are we getting themes that are coming back? Are we getting a variation on a theme? Mm-hmm. Are we taking some notes and decomposing them? Is mm-hmm. that the right word?
Deconstructing, of course.
Deconstructing, yeah. Thank you. Deconstructing them so that there's a shift. And we found that greatly in West Side Story.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I will always sit down with my musical director and go through the entire script and talk about those moments, have he or she share that with me, give me that information, because mm-hmm. that's great character work and it changes the way I direct and stage things as mm-hmm. well, to have that information. So I love it because musicals, it's almost like they're giving you even more clues.
Mm-hmm. Right. Tell me a little bit about turning straight plays into musicals. Like right. The Duchess, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yes,
I remember one of the first things you told me, because yes. I saw it at the TELUS when you had mm-hmm. done it at UBC. You're like, I've turned it into a musical. So obviously you like that rhythm, but tell me a bit about that process.
Yes, thank you. I love that piece. So this is a Linda Griffith play, and a brilliant Canadian writer. She was based in Toronto for many years, and sadly she passed away. Linda is known, too, for her very witty, very clever, very dark writing, unusual pieces, moody, funny, absurd. I would almost call her an absurdist playwright. So this was a piece about Wallace Simpson, but it was like no other... Like, it was not a BBC drama. It was like no other rendition of a British work. I was worried that it would offend people because it was quite naughty, quite sexy, very irreverent, edgy. And she had two versions of it, first of all. So I read the play, and I certainly felt when I read it that it was incomplete. I thought, oh, I love it. there's some amazing ideas in this. There's some incredible scenes, but it didn't feel like it had a clear journey. And it felt like it had quite a lot of ideas in it. So I was thrilled thinking, oh, great, she's got a revised edition. Fantastic. She'd been to PTC. She had done a two-week workshop. And I thought, well, lovely. Yes, please send me that, the updated script. So she sent me the updated script. To my great surprise, it was a completely different play. It was a completely different play. And one of her main themes, which were these fairy creatures in her first version, were gone. Mm. And they were replaced with a high society chorus. I love the high society chorus. Mm-hmm. But there were some other things about the first play that I liked better. Mm. And there were scenes that I thought were more economically written, that had some nice buttons, a joke at the end of the scene, which I really liked. So then I was facing a great dilemma. Well, which one do I do? So I wrote to her and said, how do you feel about doing some dramaturgy together? And I have some ideas because there's things I love about the first one, things I love about your most recent one. And bless her, she actually wrote back and said, the Duchess has taken years off my life. I'm not going to spend any more time doing any more writing on it. Do what you want.
Wow. Carte blanche.
Carte blanche. Oh, do what you want with it.
Great.
So, God bless her, I did a cut and paste job. Mm. I literally took, you know, I literally, in a very old-fashioned way, literally took full printed paper copies of each of these editions. And I'm not kidding, Chris King, because I'm so old school. I got my scissors out and I cut and pasted her dear script.
Oh my gosh.
And as I, you know, as I got further into it and deeper into it, I started thinking, you know, I don't think she probably envisioned that I would cut it down this much and take like one joke or one line from here and move it over here. You know, she's probably thinking I'm going to take an entire scene as she has written it and go, okay, well, I like scene 7 from this.
Right.
So I started to get nervous. Mm-hmm. One of the characters from the High Society was Noel Coward. And I happen to love Noel Coward's music. Mm-hmm. Because Noel Coward wrote quite a lot of songs, of course, and very witty lyrics. And the music is beautiful. And so I just suddenly got this idea where I thought, well, Noel Coward is the MC of the piece. Mm. Wouldn't it be great to start the show off with a song? And just started there, where I thought, oh, we'll just have him at a piano and he can do an opening song and a closing song. And maybe he could play the piano during the transitions.
And there you have it.
And maybe we could have a few more songs inside the piece.
Amazing.
And lucky for me, this very talented actor out at UBC happened to be a very charming, a great lookalike for Noel Coward, and could sing and play the piano.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we were lucky. We were very, I mean, I was just so blessed. And I'm sure you feel like this, but there's certain shows where I feel like the theater gods just sprinkle some fairy dust over me and that project.
Right.
And that was one of them. That was one of them where the stars lined up for me because this fellow was so talented. And I just, again, got so excited and started listening to all these Noel Coward songs and suddenly felt like, oh, this would work perfectly for this transition and this would work perfectly for this transition. And then what happens, and it's almost like I started to feel a little bit like a composer because I'm choosing lyrics that have a wryness and make a little statement about the scene that we've just watched or where we're going.
Right.
And as you know, again, great musicals take that kind of care and have that kind of thoughtfulness. Of course. That's something I have learned over the years from working on musicals.
Great.
And I was actually able to do this myself.
Great.
And feel very clever about all the funny moments that I created and that supported the piece. Right. Now, I never, ever imagined that Linda Griffiths would come and see the show.
Right.
Because she's got, at that time, had a very busy career in Toronto And this was obviously a student production out at UBC. Well, the day before opening, I got an email from Jerry Wasserman saying with great excitement what an honor it was going to be and how thrilled he was to share with me that Linda Griffiths, playwright, was getting on a plane and was going to be there for opening. And I thought we would be shut down. I actually thought she's going to be horrified. I have rewritten this text, moved everything around in bits and pieces, and I've turned it into a musical. Well, thank goodness she loved it. She absolutely loved it. And she was there, by the way, with her date, Daniel McIver, great Canadian playwright.
I think that was opening night, and I was there too, yes. I think I remember trying to get your attention, and I remember you being fairly nervous about this moment.
I think paralytic. I think paralytic and abstracted. I probably couldn't hold a conversation because I was a wreck, and all I could, it's like when you sit in a theater and you're trying to watch a show, but it's like your third eye is working, and all I can do and watch with the eyes at the back of my head is Linda and Daniel McIver, who are in the royal seats, the Telus Theater, the royal box there on that second level. And all I'm thinking is, are they laughing? Have they smiled yet? Have they left? Has she thrown her program down?
and that's the unfortunate thing, or the fortunate thing about the Telus, is that I know, and I think I could see you from where we were sitting, to be honest, because it's in that sort of rusty stage.
Yes, you could actually stare at the people across the way.
It's the play within the play.
It is.
What are they thinking over there? I'm glad she liked it. It was a great piece. I loved it too. And I'm glad the music really did hold it together in a lovely way. And I remember thinking, well, it's funny how it must have worked out, because if it was the original script, these would have been fairy characters.
That's right.
And you wouldn't have had Noel Coward.
That's right.
And so it's kind of serendipitous. It's amazing.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. When we revived it and we went to the Colch and Ruby Slippers and the great, beautiful Diane Brown was playing Wallace, she said to me, "Do you know, Noel Coward has all these songs. I think Wallace should have a song."
Sure.
And so we did. Amazing. And so we added a song in for Wallace, and she had this terrific solo that was just fantastic.
That's
in her scene with Hitler. So she sang to Hitler.
As one does. That's great. I'm glad it had a lovely life of its own. So it was a great production.
Do you know, Chris, there was one other show that I took that I'm particularly thrilled about, one of my favorite pieces. Favorite piece that I put a spin on to great success, and that's The 13th Chair. Mm-hmm. And that was done at Studio 58. And it was like an old, dusty melodrama from the late 1800s. It had a good cast size. So Catherine had kind of had it, I think, in her desk for years. This is Catherine Shaw, who runs the program, because it meets lots of requirements for her in terms of her lots of young characters, a nice big cast, some humor. And it was a murder mystery. Mm. But overall, dull. Mm. And that was one of those projects where I was like, can I do this play? And I love Studio 58, and I admire Catherine so much. I'm so honored to be asked. I thought, I have to do this. I want to work with this company. All the designers, amazing designers, cream of the crop, each one, when I had my first meeting with them, said, "I hate this play."
Excellent.
"What are you going to do? I can't stand it. It's dreadfully dull. What are we going to do?" And I turned that into a musical. I set it in the 1920s. I was watching Boardwalk Empire at the time and was greatly affected by the music and the choice of music in that series. And so it inspired me to work in that era, first of all, and so move it up from the 1890s and place it in 1920. It also allowed Mara Gottler to do gorgeous vintage period costumes. And that piece became a great success and one of my favorite pieces. And all the actors at the end of it went, this is my favorite project I've ever done at studio. And when I read the play, they all thought, this is going to be so boring.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, it's the 20s is a great time to put it into musically, too, at that time period. So great. Just before the Depression.
Exactly.
Cool music. Jazz was just becoming a thing, you know, really sort of main stage. So that's really cool.
Matt Grinke played live piano for us. That's and then great. At that point, he was literally Joel Grinke, the actor that had graduated at studio. It was his like kid brother who I'd heard was just this really great piano player.
Cool.
And so we brought him in.
Love it.
And of course, he works all the time now. And he is a real genius pianist. So we had a great
Yeah, we'll be back with more of Chris King's conversation with Sarah Rogers after a short break with some important information.
To prevent the spread of coronavirus 2019 or COVID-19, social distancing and self-isolation measures have been recommended. Here are some tips for managing your mental health while working from home, in self-isolation, quarantined, having to be home due to loss of employment, or just having to be home more than usual, according to @counselingforallseasons on Instagram. Try to create a structure or routine for your day. Structure helps us feel a sense of normalcy and control, and this is especially important during a time with a lot of unknowns. Routines do not have to be about productivity. Take a nap, go for a walk, or read a book. Remember to have regular meals and hydrate. This can add to a regular routine, and both of these can contribute to mood changes. If it's possible, get outside. If it's possible, get outside or open your windows. Fresh air and natural light can be beneficial to mental health. Don't be afraid to go outside. Just make sure you're observing basic social distancing. Stick to a sleep routine. Both lack of sleep and excess sleep can increase anxiety and depression. Keep up with personal hygiene and chores. Skipping personal hygiene routines can affect our moods, so try to shower, etc., even though you're not going out. Keeping your space tidy and clean can help with mental health, but it'll also contribute to preventing the spread of COVID-19. It's two birds, one stone. Remember to connect with loved ones. We might not be able to see people face to face, but that doesn't mean that those relationships are any less meaningful or important. Connection is vital to our mental health, especially in times that can feel full of despair.
My thought really about all of this is music. What music can do to a show. What music can do to the written text. And how it can lift a piece.
Do you tend to use the same amount of rehearsal time for a play or a musical? Or do you find they're different? I mean, what would you think ideal time?
Gosh, you know.
Would you like less time?
Now, which theater company am I working for? Right. How many days do I have? Well, if I had my druthers, right. If it was up to me, I would like a lot more time for a musical.
Sure.
A lot more time. Basically, we do 3-week rehearsals, right, almost for everything in professional theater. And that's if it is a 2-hander, 6-character play, 42, you know, cast of musical, which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And we do it, right, Chris?
Right, we do. Right?
It's about
that's the problem.
It's about 3 weeks. You know, it's very European. And we always say that. I mean, I've been saying that for years. So I think it still is. I mean, who knows if it's all like cut back and changed across the world. But as far as rumors go, in Europe, they will rehearse a piece for like 6 months. And it affects everything because design-wise as well. We have to make all our decisions about design before we get into rehearsal. So as you know, I meet with my designers sometimes a year in advance, and we are continuing to meet and hone in and, you know, get this design completely ready before we even rehearse. Sometimes they're in the shop building it before we've actually even started rehearsals.
So you do have to know what you're doing artistically ahead.
You have to know way ahead. And that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's great. But it allows no room for error. Mm-hmm. It allows no room for any major design changes. So yes, of course, there can be adjustments. But I think what's so fabulous about Europe is they actually get in and take the time to work with the actors and rehearse and refine the design. And if they decide after 2 weeks, oh, this design doesn't work, they can toss it out and completely do a different design. Right.
Because obviously actors can bring something new to a piece when you're in rehearsal and you go, wait, that's a much better idea.
Oh, absolutely. And in terms of costumes, you're so right. Mm-hmm. As you know, this year with West Side, because we had more time, mm-hmm. I actually included the actors in the design for costumes,
right.
which I would love to do. I know as an actor for myself, it's happened to me before where I've spent time prepping and doing my homework and I have a strong sense of what I think this character is and who they are. And then I come to the first day of rehearsal. And often at the first day, it's the first time that you're getting a glimpse as an actor into the director and designer's idea for the character.
Right.
And sometimes it can be wildly different. And who are you as a young actor to say to this great designer?
Yeah.
You know,
I was thinking
that I would be in a big fat suit and I'm
done a lot of research on fat suits.
That's right.
How do you like actors to be in the rehearsal room? Like, how do you like
attentive?
Sure. And in sort of more the way, like, are there some no things that like people should not do?
Don't cut your hair without talking to the actor, talking to the director and the designer first. You know, that's one of my pet peeves.
Yes.
And it's amazing how often that happens.
It is.
But you can't change your look. Don't change your look until you know, often you've been cast. You've come to an audition mm-hmm. and we love you. We love the way you look. But yes, cutting hair.
Right.
You know, oh my goodness. I just love smart actors. Mm-hmm. I love open actors. And when I say open, I mean they're open to play. They're open to ideas. They're not fixed.
Right.
And rigid in their thoughts about the character. I love to collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not frightened by an actor who asks lots of questions. Or even challenges.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind that. I'm really excited to talk in the rehearsal room and discuss. And as you know, I always feel like 10 smart brains in the room are better than one.
Mm.
So bring out the smarts and challenge me and question and ask and offer.
So you like offers. Yeah.
I love mm-hmm. offers. I love people that come in with ideas. And I always felt as an actor that I would try to bring in 3 new things a week, you know, 3 new things a week, whether that's a bit of shtick, a lotsy, a new approach to a scene, a new idea for a moment, that kind of thing, right?
Mm.
Business. So, you know, don't ever stop with making new offers. It's so great to, as a director then, to edit. Like how wonderful to have all these great offers.
Mm.
And then it's my job to edit and go, okay, this is not supporting the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely bit, but it's not helping move the story along, or it's going against the story and those kinds of things.
That's great. How do you feel about keeping your aesthetic and your vision through rehearsals and working with a production team? So obviously in a play, you're a little bit more on an island as
yes.
a director.
Yes.
In a
yes.
musical, you have choreographer, you have music director.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find any challenges or you find certain things easy about keeping your aesthetic? And what I mean by that, and for people that don't know,
mm-hmm.
Sarah Rogers has a beautiful minimal aesthetic when it comes to a lot of set design with acting. We talked about it at the beginning too, about sort of lean and mm-hmm. All those things. How do you find challenging keeping that through rehearsals with a team of people?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think that the key is to lay all that down early on, and it's always communication.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what happens, of course, as time goes on, that's so funny because when I was a young actor, I used to think, oh, you know, Morris Panych and Ken MacDonald are such a great team, but they always work together, like they're partners, and they also always, you know, he always has Ken design his shows. Well, And you think, oh, how lovely wouldn't it be for other designers to be able to get to work with the great Morris Panitch, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they're not getting those opportunities. Well, now I know, because as a director, once you find the designer that has your aesthetic, that gets it, that understands you, and not only that, enhances you and your vision, you don't want to have anybody else. Right. So, you know, I can say that Kevin McAllister was really instrumental in my early days of directing in terms of economical designs and transformative sets, which is also something that I love greatly. And it was hard to work with anybody beyond that, because all I wanted to do is work with Kevin. Lucky for me, Drew Facey is an absolutely stunning designer, as well as Brian Ball, too, who's just done some beautiful work for us. And what's really interesting about Brian, and I wonder what he would think, but my sense is that Brian isn't necessarily an economical designer. He's a painter.
Yeah,
a beautiful painter. So he's an artist. So he's a real artist. So his sets and designs often, of course, involve drops and flats that are painted. And so I that's where I feel like we've done some stunning work together, because I'm bringing in a little bit of a more edited and I'm asking him to edit his work. And so I'm kind of challenging him on that respect. And then he's challenging my aesthetic with paint, with painting, and bringing in some beautiful, beautiful looks as well. So that's been a really happy marriage. It hasn't always been smooth. I did a play years ago, St. Joan, Bernard Shaw, for Shemanis. And it was a Russian designer, and I will tell you, I have literally forgotten his name. It's gone. I think I've erased it, and I'm sure he's forgotten mine. Or, you know, spits after he says my name. Right. Swears and spits. Because it was one of those amazing, where it didn't matter how often we met, and we met so often, and I kept describing what I wanted. I wanted this wall, a stone wall, very plain stone wall. And then pieces would come out of the wall that would become furniture in the room. And then it would leave a hole in the background that would create a window, for example. So if I wanted to pull out a table, it would come out of the wall, it would go down, and then it would open up, and it would be like a window, a silhouette of a window. So one day I will do this design, because it's really cool and I think it'll look really amazing. And for Joan, for that era, that's what I wanted to. I just wanted this like really simple stone wall. Well, I just kept getting kind of a fairy tale wall. It was so colorful. It was really cute. It was something that you would, that I would feel would come in like a TYA show for Princess and the Pea or something, you know?
TYA Joan.
Yeah, TYA Joan. And she doesn't, you know, get burned at the stake at the end.
No, no.
Because it was far too jolly and cheerful. And it just, and I'm sure that this dear fellow would say that, you know, he did what I asked, you know? It was just one of those strange communication things. And I had to do one of the hardest things I've ever done as a director, which is when we got on that set and the wall, and it was so cumbersome, and it was also very cumbersome. This is where you need a really, really good technician and designers as well, because, you know, as a director, I can have all these grand ideas and, oh, you're just going to pull these pieces out of the wall. But of course, it was really hard. It was really hard to pull these things out. The actors were killing themselves, killing themselves. They were like breaking out in a sweat, and people were getting it hurt and splinters and injured. And I just remember thinking the play looked better in the rehearsal room. With nothing.
Right.
I just kept thinking that final run in the rehearsal room where we had no set was better than this. And so I had to sit my entire team down and say, I would like to cut the set. We're going to have no set. We're going to, and thank heavens we had a raked stage. So I said, we will have a raked stage. We will bring the furniture on. We'll use the furniture. It'll just live in the wings. We'll bring it on as needed, but we will cut the wall completely. So it ended up looking like almost in theater history books. And right. You look at the chapter from the 60s, mm-hmm. and there's often like Waiting for Godot, and you have a rake stage and then a big psych, mm-hmm. right? And there's nothing but maybe like a tree. If it was Godot, you'd have this little tree, right?
Yes,
and
lots of shadows.
And that's it, right? And so, you know, it was this crazy, ballsy move. Mm. And I was certainly, you know, I didn't make all, what? I didn't, I want to say, not everybody loved me for it, but I was lucky enough to have the majority of the team and the generosity of the crew and the TD at the time at Chemainus, mm-hmm. To be very supportive.
Great.
And say, yes, this is better. This is better.
You wanted to make sure that it's enhancing the show. At that point, rather than detracting.
Exactly, exactly.
Especially with a piece like that, you know, which, you know, has a certain bleakness to it.
It does.
Do you think that you are unusual in the case? Leading question. And because I've worked with many directors also, and I know that some of them like to go to their designers with very vague ideas. And some like go with very specific ideas. And I know that you're very specific.
I'm never vague. Yeah. I'm never vague.
Do you think you're in unusual in that case? Like you go in with very specific
ideas? That's a good question. I think that all good directors have strong thoughts and clarity mm-hmm. about the piece. I think that you're right that I'm unusual in my approach to conceptualizing a lot of work, so that I come in with a strong idea of a piece that is not already inherent to it. And so I think that's unique. And certainly maybe because of my design aesthetic, that's a great question. I should really ask like Drew and Kevin. Mm. I think sometimes because I have such a strong vision of how I see the piece, I do sometimes come in with a show designed. Allison Green, phenomenal designer, who's going to be designing for me again at the Arts Club for the audience. And I just love her, and I love working with her. And, you know, she's a real straight shooter. Mm. And she's also an old vet. She's been doing it for years and years and years. And I had a very strong vision about Pride and Prejudice and how I wanted to do that piece, and I wanted to do it all with easels, and I wanted it to be all paintings on easels. And that was very different because she was expecting to do all the rooms and the interiors and the architecture, and she's very good at that as well. Luckily, and lucky for me, and she's so open, she loved the idea, and then made even more and more and more offers. Mm. But she was a hoot because every time we had a production meeting or a design meeting with the other designers, she would always say, well, Sarah designed it. Sarah designed the set. Well, Sarah designed it. Mm-hmm. And that was not Drew, but so generous of her. Mm. But it gave me a little insight mm-hmm. that for me, I just had a concept. So I just shared my concept. Right. But you see, for her, it's so specific, mm-hmm. like very specific to you know, how I want the transitions to happen and how I want, at times, not always, but I had some very specific ideas about when I wanted the easels to go and what I wanted them to do mm-hmm. and how I wanted them to transform. And so maybe that is different mm-hmm. and unique. The fact that she would turn around and say, you know, Sarah designed the set. So, you know, maybe there are directors who have strong thoughts about the play, but don't have a strong vision about how they want to see the design. I did A Child's Christmas in Wales, and that was the first show that I did with Kevin McAllister. And we had our first meeting, and I said, I don't need a set. I don't want anything. And he just said, what? I said, no, I don't want anything because it's storytelling. And it goes interior and exterior and, you know, and so I actually don't need it. I don't need a set. like I was kind of like saying, you know, go away. Yeah.
Just write me a letter. Just
don't impose anything, because I can, I've staged the entire thing in my brain, and I don't want anything that will lock us down, particularly to the interior, because it goes out so much. Right. And so he said to me, what is the main image for you in the piece? Mm. You know, if what's the number one thing? And I said, snow. Mm. Snow. It comes up again and again and again. And we start, in fact, with a snowball. They plunge their hands into the snowball and pull out whatever they can find. Mr. Prothero is standing in the living room, and it starts there. And so he said, all right, what about a snowbank? I said, I love it. I can have a snowbank. I can work with that. And so he created this beautiful snowbank.
That's amazing. What theater was that?
This was Chimenez. And it was my very first production there.
Right.
And dear Jeremy Tao. And again, he had come to UBC and he had seen Under Milkwood that I had done. And from the strength of that production, he literally called me up and said, would you like to direct Charles Christmas in Wales? And how do you feel about writing an adaptation of it? Because he said, there's only one play that I can find out there. And he wasn't keen on it. Mm. Because the piece is only about 20 minutes long. If you were to read A Child's Christmas in Wales from beginning to end, it's about a 20-minute piece. And he wanted a two-hour play. So my father, Dennis Rogers, and I sat down, and with a great deal of help from my daddy, who is a lovely writer, we pieced together some short stories of Dylan Thomas. And so we created more memories. We kind of filled out the memories of the young boy in Wales, the life in Wales.
Great. That's amazing. And you made a full two-hour play. That's good. Out of a 20-minute piece. That's amazing. Auditions, you know, people coming in and auditioning for you. In a musical, what are you looking for when somebody comes in? I mean, obviously that's character specific, but are there things that are general?
Yes, and I think you know, Chris, from working for me as well, that I'm always looking for strong actors first. Then there's the technical things that you have to tick off. And so, of course, singing and dancing. And you have to take care to really know the piece well and look at the piece and say, is there an area that we could sacrifice for something else that is more important?
Hmm. When an actor comes in and you don't know them, like if there's somebody new to you, what it is that stands out to you when somebody comes in that you know that are good?
That's a great question. And, oh, I'm really glad you asked this, because here I am saying that I'm looking for actors first. And inside that, I'm looking for, it's always choices, right, Chris?
Right.
So this is, whether it's a song, or whether it's a scene or monologue that they're coming in and doing at their callback, is I'm looking for inventive choices. I'm looking for freshness. I'm looking for somebody, if it's a comedy, that understands the humor and can bring some wit to it. So for people out there, and I would be one of them, who are not strong singers, who do not feel confident singing, who are scared to death about coming in, especially for first impressions, into a room where they don't know people and feel like, I don't have the vocal chops of that woman that just went in before me. And then they have to come in. With me, I say, don't worry. It's the storytelling. It's your acting. As we've talked about earlier, the song is a monologue. It's a soliloquy. And you're still going to make choices as an actor inside that song.
Right.
And you have an opportunity to show yourself, to show your wit, to show your humor, to show the depth of emotion if you're singing a ballad and it's a serious song. So you can touch us and move us with the honesty of your singing, because that takes acting, even if you're not hitting all the right notes.
Right.
And Chris, you know, we've cast people. Mm-hmm. We've cast people that have a vulnerability in singing, and then we look after them. We've solved that. We find a way to look after that and help them vocally so that we can have their wonderful acting chops that they bring to the piece.
You try and give, especially in amateur theater or like Tuts, for instance, where we don't have all professionals, that you try and approach people that have schooling that have gone to UBC or studio or even, you know, CAP students, that you try and incorporate a mix of people that have that education. Do you feel that's important?
I think it's so important. First of all, I always look at training. Like, you know, you want people that are trained. I love to have a mix, and West Side Story particularly, we had it. Incredible mix. We had people from UBC, from Studio 58, from Cap College, from CCPA. It was just lovely. And I think it's vital. I mean, that's the real world. That's what it's like as an actor for me when I work in professional companies. Everybody's trained some, you know, across the country. And it's so lovely to bring those different disciplines in to see people who warm up differently, who have different approaches to the work. And as artists, we learn from that in the room. And so it's important to me.
Oh. I know it's sort of a hot button issue, but what are your thoughts about diversity in theater?
I think it's a great hot button. I think it's good. I think it's been a long time coming. And I'm glad to say to actors today who are graduating, the ethnic actors, the actors that can bring diversity to a piece, how wonderful to be able to say, hey, you could work a lot. There's going to be lots of opportunities for you. For years and years and years, and certainly when I went through UBC, any actor who was of Asian descent, they would struggle. And there were some wonderful actors over the years that I feel came out, and then unless they were able to find a niche in film and TV, they certainly were not going to be able to be on the boards for live theater. And so I'm so thrilled that, you know, finally we're in a world where it's not only about casting Puerto Rican, going, okay, I'm going to find, you know, work really hard, as you know, we did. We worked really hard to honor Latinos and find like authentic, real people of Latin descent to be on our stage. But it, also what's happening today is blind color casting. And I think that's what's taken so long to come. And I love that. And it's great to see. And I worked very hard to do it with Pride and Prejudice at the Arts Club. And so we had, you know, my Bennett sisters were a mix of Caucasian, Filipino, and African Canadian. And it was quite shocking, I think, for many patrons to come to see it's like a Merchant Ivory film, you know, to come and see Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen of that era, and have the Bennett sisters come running on. And we all have such strong cliche, stereotypical thoughts in our head. We've also seen so many miniseries of what those young girls look like. So to suddenly see, you know, a Lydia come running out that is African Canadian and a Mary that is Filipino, I think was surprising to people. But what I love is that the acting is great and beautiful. Everybody just then accepts it. And to me, the bottom line always is that you have to win the role because you're the best for it, because you're the best actor for it. So that's all I care about. And that's what I cared about with Pride and Prejudice. It just was like, bring in these talented actors that I know, and whoever read the best are the ones that won the role.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. So
it's my pleasure, Chris. Lovely. It was just a joy to talk to you and be here today.
Thanks.
And that's our show. Thanks for spending your lunch hour with us. Remember, if you want to keep in the know about theater happenings and not happenings in these wacky times, Theater Wire and Colin Thomas's Fresh Sheet are both doing great reporting and deserve our support. If you missed any or all of today's show or want to relive glorious moments from the past, you can check out our podcast archive at citr.ca. And you can also find us on player.fm. And remember to subscribe and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts. Stick around. Audrey is up next with her home version of Too Dreamy, followed by Beppe Crespin at 2 o'clock and our very own star on the BC Entertainment Walk of Fame, Nardwar the Human Serviette, at 3:30. Dave Radio will return next week at this same time. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.